Bring Up the Bodies, Disc 3.
These are sounds of Austin Friars in the autumn of 1535. The singing children rehearsing a motet, breaking off, beginning again. The voices of these children, small boys, calling out to each other from staircases, and nearer at hand, the scrabbling of dogs' paws on the boards, the chink of gold pieces into a chest, the susurration, tapestry muffled, of polyglot conversation, the whisper of ink across paper. Beyond the walls, the noises of the city, the milling of the crowds at his gate, distant cries from the river. His inner monologue, running on, soft-voiced. It is in public rooms that he thinks of the cardinal, his footsteps echoing in lofty, vaulted chambers. It is in private spaces that he thinks of his wife Elizabeth. She is a blur now in his mind, a whisk of skirts around a corner. That last morning of her life, as he left the house, he thought he saw her following him, caught a flash of her white cap. He had half turned, saying to her, "Go back to bed." But no one was there. By the time he came home that night, her jaw was bound and there were candles at her head and feet. It was only a year before his girls died of the same cause. In his house at Stepney, he keeps in a locked box their necklaces of pearl and coral, Anne's copy books with her Latin exercises, and in the storeroom where they keep their play costumes for Christmas. He still has the wings made of peacock feathers that Grace wore in a parish play. After the play, she walked upstairs, still in her wings. Frost glittered at the window. "I'm going to say my prayers," she said, walking away from him, furled in her feathers, fading into dusk. And now night falls on Austin Friars. Snap of bolts, click of key and lock, rattle of strong chain across wicket, and the great bar fallen across the main gate. The boy Dick Purser lets out the watchdogs. They pounce and race, they snap at the moonlight, they flop under the fruit trees, heads on paws and ears twitching. When the house is quiet, when all his houses are quiet, then dead people walk about on the stairs. And the Queen sends for him to her own chamber. It is after supper. Only a step for him, as at every major palace rooms are reserved for him now, near the King's. Just a staircase, and there, with the light of a sconce lapping at its gold trim, is the stiff new doublet of Mark Smeaton. Mark himself is lurking inside it. What brings Mark here? He is without musical instruments as an excuse, and he has got up as gorgeously as any of the young lords who wait on Anne. Is there justice, he wonders? Mark does naught and gets more bonny each time I see him, and I do everything and get more grey and paunchy by the day. Since unpleasantness usually ensues between them, it is in his mind to pass by with a nod, but Mark stands up straight and smiles. "Lord Cromwell, how are you?" "Ah, no," he says. "Still plain master?" "It is a natural mistake. You seem every inch the lord, and surely the king will do something for you soon."
"Perhaps not. He needs me in the House of Commons."
"Even so," the boy murmurs, "it would seem ungracious in him when others are rewarded for much less service. Tell me, they say you have got music scholars in your house."
"A dozen or so merry little boys saved from the cloister. They work at their books and practice their instruments, and at table they learn their manners. At supper they entertain his guests. They practice with the bow and play fetch with the spaniels, and the littlest ones drag their hobby horses over the cobbles and follow him about.
'Sir, sir, sir, look at me. Do you want to see me stand on my hands?'
They keep the household lively," he says.
"If you should ever want someone to put a polish on their performance, think of me."
"I will, Mark." He thinks, "I wouldn't trust you around my little boys."
"You will find the Queen discontented," the young man says. "You know her brother Rochford has lately gone into France on a special embassy, and today he has sent a letter. It seems to be the common talk over there that Catherine has been writing to the Pope, asking him to put into effect that wicked sentence of excommunication he has pronounced against our master, and which would result in untold hurts and perils to our realm."
He nods, yes, yes, yes. He does not need Mark to tell him what excommunication is. Can he not make it short?
The Queen is angry, the boy says. For if this is so, Catherine is a plain traitor, and the Queen wonders why do we not act against her.
Suppose I tell you the reason, Mark. Would you take it in to her? It seems you could save me an hour or two.
If you would entrust me,
the boy begins, then sees his cold smile. He blushes. I trust you with a motet, Mark. Although, he looks at him thoughtfully, it does seem to me that you must stand high in the Queen's favour.
Master Secretary, I believe that I do.
Flattened, Mark is already bouncing back.
It is we lesser men often who are most fit for royal confidence.
Well then, barons meeting, eh, before long? I shall be the first to congratulate you, even if I am still toiling on the benches of the Commons.
With a whisk of her hand, Anne shoos away the ladies around her, who bob to him and whisper out. Her sister-in-law, George's wife, lingers. Anne says,
"Thank you, Lady Rochford. I shall not need you again tonight."
Only her fool stays with her, a dwarf woman peeping at him from behind the Queen's chair. Anne's hair is loose beneath a cap of silver tissue shaped like a crescent moon. He makes a mental note of it. The women about him always inquire what Anne is wearing. This is how she receives her husband, the dark tresses displayed only for him, and incidentally for Cromwell, who is a tradesman's son and doesn't matter any more than the boy Mark does. She begins, as she often does, as if in the middle of a sentence.
"So I want you to go, up country, to see her. Very secret. Only take the men you need. Here, you may read my brother Rochford's letter."
She flourishes it at her fingers' ends, then changes her mind, whips it back.
"Or no,"
she says, and decides to sit on it instead. Perhaps, amid the news, it contains dispraise of Thomas Cromwell.
"I am very suspicious of Catherine, very suspicious. It seems they know in France what we only guess at. Your people are not vigilant, perhaps. My lord brother believes the Queen is urging the Emperor to invade, as is the Ambassador Chapuis, who, by the way, should be banished this kingdom."
"Well, you know," he says, "we can't go throwing ambassadors out, because then we don't get to know anything at all."
Truth is, he is not afraid of Catherine's intrigues. The mood between France and the Empire is at the moment unremittingly hostile, and if open war breaks out, the Emperor will have no troops to spare for invading England. These things swing about in a week, and the Boleyn reading of any situation he has noticed is always a little behind the times, and influenced by the fact that they pretend to have special friends at the Valois court. Anne is still in pursuit of a royal marriage for her ginger little daughter. He used to admire her as a person who learned from her mistakes, who would pull back, recalculate. But she has a streak of stubbornness to equal that of Catherine, the old queen, and it seems in this matter she will never learn. George Boleyn has been over to France again, intriguing for the match, but with no result. What's George Boleyn for? That's a question he asks himself. He says,
"Highness, the king could not compromise his honour by any ill-treatment of the queen that was. If it became known, it would be a personal embarrassment to him."
Anne looks sceptical. She does not grasp the idea of embarrassment. The lights are low. Her silver head bobs, glittering and small. The dwarf fusses and chuckles, muttering to herself out of sight. Seated on her velvet cushions, Anne dangles her velvet slipper like a child about to dip a toe in a stream.
"If I were Catherine, I too would intrigue. I would not forgive. I would do as she does."
She gives him a dangerous smile.
"You see, I know her mind. Though she is a Spaniard, I can put myself in her place. You would not see me meek if Henry cast me off. I too would want war."
She takes a strand of hair between fingers and thumb, runs its length, thoughtful.
"However, the king believes she is ailing. She and her daughter both, they are always mewling. Their stomachs are disordered or their teeth falling out. They have agues or rheum. They are up all night puking and down all day moaning, and all their pain is due to Anne Boleyn. So look, do you, Cromwell, go and see her without warning. Then tell me if she is feigning or no.
She maintains, as an affectation, a skittish slur in her speech, the odd French intonation, her inability to say his name. There is a stir at the door. The king is coming in. He makes a reverence, and does not rise or curtsy. She says, without preliminary,
I have told him, Henry, to go.
I wish you would, Cromwell, and give us your own report. There is no one like you for seeing into the nature of things. When the Emperor wants a stick to beat me with, he says his aunt is dying of neglect and cold and shame. Well, she has servants. She has firewood.
And as for shame, Anne says, she should die inside when she thinks of the lies she has told.
Majesty, he says, I shall ride at dawn and tomorrow send Ralph Sadler to you, if you permit, with the day's agenda. The king groans.
No escape from your big lists?
No, sir, for if I gave you a respite, you would forever have me on the road on some pretext. Till I return, would you just sit on the situation?
Anne shifts in her chair, Brother George's letter under her.
I shall do nothing without you, Henry says. Take care. The roads are treacherous. I shall be your beadsman. Good night.
He looks about the outer chamber, but Mark has vanished, and there is only a knot of matrons and maids, Mary Shelton, Jane Seymour, and Elizabeth, the Earl of Worcester's wife. Who's missing?
Where is Lady Rochford? He says, smiling. Do I see her shape behind the arras?
He indicates Anne's chamber.
Going to bed, I think. So you girls get her installed, and then you will have the rest of the night for your ill behaviour.
They giggle. Lady Worcester makes creepy motions with her finger.
9 of the clock, and here comes Harry Norris, bare beneath his shirt. Run, Mary Shelton, run rather slowly.
Who do you run from, Lady Worcester?
Thomas Cromwell, I could not possibly tell you. A married woman like myself?
Teasing, smiling, she creeps her fingers along his upper arm.
We all know where Harry Norris would like to lie tonight. Shelton is only his bed warmer for now. He has royal ambitions. He will tell anyone. He is sick with love for the Queen. I shall play cards, Jane Seymour says, with myself, so there will be no undue losses. Master, is there any news of Lady Catherine?
I have nothing to tell you. Sorry.
Lady Worcester's glance follows him. She is a fine woman, careless and rather free-spending, no older than the Queen. Her husband is away, and he feels she too could run rather slowly, if he gave her the nod. But then a countess, and he a humble master, and sworn to the road before sunrise. They ride up country towards Catherine without banner or display, a tight knot of armed men. It is a clear day and bitter cold. The brown tussocky land shows through layers of hard frost and herons flap from frozen pools. Clouds stack and shift on the horizon, slate grey and a mild deceptive rose. Leading them from early afternoon is a silvered moon as mean as a clipped coin. Christophe rides beside him, growing more voluble and disgusted the further they travel from urban comfort.
Indeed, the king chose a hard country for Catherine. He hopes the mould will get into her bones and she will die.
He has no such thought. Kimbolton is an old house, but very sound. She has every comfort. Her household costs the king £4,000 a year. It is no mean sum.
He leaves Christophe to ponder that locution. No mean sum. At last the boy says,
Spaniards are merde anyway.
You watch the track and keep Jenny's feet out of holes. Any spills and I'll have you follow me home on a donkey.
Ha-ha!
Christophe bellows, loud enough to make the men-at-arms turn in their saddles.
French donkey,
he explains. French fuckwit, one says, amiably enough. Riding beneath dark trees at the close of that first day's travel, they sing. It lifts the tired heart and dispels spirits lurking in the verges. Never underestimate the superstition of the average Englishman. As this year closes,
The favourite will be variations on the song the king wrote himself. Pass time with good company, I love and shall until I die. The variations are only mildly obscene, or he would feel obliged to check them. The landlord of their inn is a harassed wisp of a man who does his futile best to find out whom he is entertaining. His wife is a strong, discontented young woman with angry blue eyes and a loud voice. He has brought his own travelling cook.
"What, my lord?" she says. "You think we poison you?"
He can hear her banging around in the kitchen, laying down what shall and shan't be done with her skillets. She comes to his chamber late and asks, "Do you want anything?" He says no, but she comes back. "What? Really, nothing?" "You might lower your voice," he says. "This far from London, the king's deputy in church affairs can perhaps relax his caution." "Stay, then," he tells her. "Noisy she may be, but safer than Lady Worcester." He wakes before dawn, so suddenly that he doesn't know where he is. He can hear a woman's voice from below, and for a moment he thinks he is back at the sign of the Pegasus, with his sister Cat crashing about, and that it is the morning of his flight from his father, that all his life is before him. But cautiously, in the dark chamber without a candle, he moves each limb. No bruises. He is not cut. He remembers where he is and what he is. He moves into the warmth the woman's body has left, and dozes, an arm thrown across the bolster. Soon he hears his landlady singing on the stairs. 12 virgins went out on a May morning, it seems, and none of them came back. She has scooped up the money he left her. On her face, as she greets him, no sign of the night's transaction. But she comes out and speaks to him, her voice low as they prepare to ride. Christoph, with a lordly air, pays the reckoning to their host. The day is milder, and their progress swift and without event. Certain images will be all that remain from his ride into Middle England. The holly berries burning in their bushes, the startled flight of a woodcock, flushed from almost beneath their hooves, the feeling of venturing into a watery place where soil and marsh are the same colour, and nothing is solid under your feet. Kimbolton is a busy market town, but at twilight the streets are empty. They have made no great speed, but it is futile to wear out horses on a task that is important but not urgent. Catherine will live or die at her own pace. Besides, it is good for him to get out to the country. Squeezed in London's alleys, edging horse or mule under her jetties and gables, the mean canvas of her sky pierced by broken roofs, one forgets what England is. How broad the fields, how wide the sky, how squalid and ignorant the populace. They pass a wayside cross that shows recent signs of excavation at its base. One of the men-at-arms says, "They think the monks are burying their treasure, hiding it from our master here." "So they are," he says, "but not under crosses. They're not that foolish." In the main street they draw rein at the church.
"What for?" says Christoph.
"I need a blessing," he says. "You need to make your confession, sir," one of the men says. Smiles are exchanged. It is harmless. No one thinks the worse of him, only that their own beds were cold. He has noticed this, that men who have not met him dislike him, but when they have met him, only some of them do. "We could have put up a monastery," one of his guard had complained, "but no girls in a monastery, I suppose." He had turned in the saddle. "You really think that?" Knowing laughter from the men. In the church's frigid interior, his escort flap their arms across their bodies. They stamp their feet and cry, "Brrr," like bad actors.
"I'll whistle for a priest," Christoph says.
"You'll do no such thing." But he grins. Can imagine his young self saying it and doing it too. But there is no need to whistle. Some suspicious janitor is edging in with a light. No doubt a messenger is stumbling towards the great house with news. "Watch out, make ready, lords are here." It is decorous for Catherine to have some warning, he feels, but not too much.
"Imagine it," Christoph says. "We might burst in on her when she is plucking her whiskers, which women of that age do."
To Christoph, the former queen is a broken jade, a crone. He thinks Catherine would be my age, or thereabouts. But life is harsher to women, particularly women who, like Catherine, have been blessed with many children and seen them die. Silently, the priest arrives at his elbow, a timid fellow who wants to show the church his treasures. "Now you must be," he runs through a list in his head, "William Lord?"
"Ah, no."
"This is some other William." A long explanation ensues. He cuts it short. "As long as your bishop knows who you are." Behind him is an image of St. Edmund, the man with 500 fingers. The saint's feet are pointed daintily as if he is dancing. "Hold up the lights," he says. "Is that a mermaid?"
"Yes, my lord."
A shadow of anxiety crosses the priest's face.
"Must she come down? Is she forbidden?"
He smiles. "I just thought she's a long way from the sea."
"She's stinking fish,"
Christoph yells with laughter. "Forgive the boy, he's no poet." A feeble smile from the priest. On an oak screen, St. Anne holds a book for the instruction of her little daughter, the Virgin Mary. St. Michael the Archangel hacks away with a scimitar at a devil entwining his feet.
"Are you here to see the Queen, sir? I mean,"
the priest corrects himself,
"the Lady Catherine?"
"This priest doesn't know me from Adam," he thinks. "I could be an emissary. I could be Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk. I could be Thomas Howard, Duke of Norfolk. They have both tried on Catherine their scant persuasive powers and their best bully boy tricks." He doesn't give his name, but he leaves an offering. The priest's hand enfolds the coins as if to warm them.
"You will forgive my slip, my lord. Over the lady's title, I swear I meant no harm by it. For an old countryman such as I am, it is hard to keep up with the changes. By the time we have understood one report from London, it is contradicted by the next."
"It's hard for us all," he says, shrugging. "You pray for Queen Anne every Sunday?"
"Of course, my lord."
"And what do your parishioners say to that?"
The priest looks embarrassed.
"Well, sir, they are simple people. I would not pay heed to what they say. Though they are all very loyal," he adds hastily, "very loyal."
"No doubt. Will you please me now and this Sunday in your prayers to remember Tom Wolsey?"
The late cardinal? He sees the old fellow revising his ideas. This can't be Thomas Howard or Charles Brandon. For if you speak the name of Wolsey, they can hardly restrain themselves from spitting at your feet. When they leave the church, the last light is vanishing into the sky, and a stray snowflake drifts along across the south. They remount. It has been a long day. His clothes feel heavy on his back. He doesn't believe the dead need our prayers, nor can they use them. But anyone who knows the Bible as he does knows that our God is a capricious God, and there's no harm in hedging your bets. When the woodcock flew up in its flash of reddish brown, his heart had knocked hard. As they rode, he was aware of it, each beat a heavy wing beat. As the bird found the concealment of trees, its tracing of feathers inked out to black. They arrive in the half-dark, a hallooing from the walls and an answering shout from Christoph.
"Thomas Cromwell, secretary to the king and master of the rolls!" "How do we know you?"
a sentry bellows.
"Show your colours!"
"Tell him show a light and let me in," he says, "or I'll show his backside my boot."
He has to say these things when he's up country. It's expected of him, the king's common adviser. The drawbridge must come down for them, an antique scrape, a creak and rattling of bolts and chains. At Kimbolton they lock in early. Good.
"Remember," he says to his party, "do not make the priest's mistake. When you talk to her household, she is the Dowager Princess of Wales."
"What?" Christoph says.
"She is not the king's wife. She never was the king's wife. She is the wife of the king's deceased brother, Arthur, Prince of Wales."
"Deceased means dead," Christoph says. "I know it."
"She is not a queen or former queen, as her second so-called marriage was not licit."
"That is not permissible," Christoph says. "She make the mistake of conjugation with both brothers, Arthur first, then Henry."
"And what are we to think of such a woman?" he says, smiling. Flare of torches and taking form out of dimness, Sir Edmund Bedingfield, Catherine's keeper.
"I think you might have warned us, Cromwell." "Grace, you didn't want warning of me, did you?"
He kisses Lady Bedingfield.
"I didn't bring my supper. But there's a mule cart behind me, it will be here tomorrow. I have venison for your own table, and some almonds for the Queen, and a sweet wine that Chapuis says she favours."
"I am glad of anything that will tempt her appetite." Grace Bedingfield leads the way into the great hall. In the firelight she stops and turns to him. "Her doctor suspects she has a growth in her belly, but it may take a long course, when you would think she has suffered enough, poor lady." He hands his gloves, his riding coat, to Christophe.
"Will you wait upon her straight away?" Bedingfield asks. "Though we were not expecting you, she may be. It is hard for us, because the townspeople favour her, and word slips in with servants. You cannot prevent it. I believe they stand and signal from beyond the moat. I think she knows most of what goes on, who passes on the road."
Two ladies, Spanish by their dress and well advanced in age, press themselves against a plaster wall and look at him with resentment. He bows to them, and one remarks in her own tongue that this is the man who has sold the King of England's soul. The wall behind them is painted, he sees, with the fading figures of a scene from paradise. Adam and Eve, hand in hand, stroll among beasts so new to creation they have not yet learned their names. A small elephant with a rolling eye peeps shyly through the foliage. He has never seen an elephant, but understood them to be higher by far than a war horse. Perhaps it's not had time to grow yet. Branches bowed with fruit hang above its head.
"Well, you know the form," Bedingfield says. "She lives in that room and has her ladies, those ones, cook for her over the fire. You knock and go in, and if you call her Lady Catherine, she kicks you out. And if you call her Your Highness, she lets you stay. So I call her nothing. You, I call her, as if she were a girl that scrubs the steps."
Catherine is sitting by the fire, shrunk into a cape of very good ermines. The king will want that back, he thinks, if she dies. She glances up and puts out a hand for him to kiss. Unwilling, but more because of the chill, he thinks, than because she is reluctant to acknowledge him. She is jaundiced, and there is an invalid fug in the room, the faint animal scent of the furs, a vegetal stench of undrained cooking water, and the sour reek from a bowl with which a girl hurries away, containing, he suspects, the evacuated contents of the dowager's stomach. If she is ill in the night, perhaps she dreams of the gardens of the Alhambra, where she grew up, the marble pavements, the bubbling of crystal water into basins, the drag of a white peacock's tail and the scent of lemons. "I could have brought her a lemon in my saddlebag," he thinks. As if reading his thoughts, she speaks to him in Castilian.
"Master Cromwell, let us abandon this weary pretense that you do not speak my language."
He nods.
"It has been hard in times past, standing by while your maids talked about me. Jesu, isn't he ugly? Do you think he has a hairy body like Satan?"
"My maids said that."
Catherine seems amused. She withdraws her hand out of his sight.
"They are long gone, those lively girls. Only old women remain, and a handful of licensed traitors."
"Madam, those about you love you."
"They report on me, all my words. They even listen in to my prayers." "Well, master,"
she raises her face to the light,
"how do you think I look? What will you say of me when the king asks you? I have not seen myself in a mirror these many months."
She pats her fur cap, pulls its lappets over her ears, laughs.
"The king used to call me an angel. He used to call me a flower. When my first son was born, it was the depths of winter. All England lay under snow. There were no flowers to be had, I thought. But Henry gave me 6 dozen roses made of the purest white silk. White as your hand, my love," he said, and kissed my fingertips.
A twitch beneath the ermine tells him where a bunched fist lies now.
"I keep them in a chest, the roses. They at least do not fade. Over the years I have given them to those who have done me some service.
She pauses. Her lips move. A silent invocation. Prayers for departed souls.
Tell me, how is Boleyn's daughter? They say she prays a good deal to her reformed God.
She has indeed a reputation for piety, as she has the approbation of the scholars and bishops.
They are using her, as she is using them. If they were true churchmen, they would shrink from her in horror, as they would shrink from an infidel. But I expect she is praying for a son. She lost the last child, I am told. Ah, well, I know how that is. I pity her from the bottom of my heart.
She and the king have hopes of another child soon.
What? Particular hope or general hope?
He pauses. Nothing definite has been said. Gregory could be wrong.
I thought she confided in you,
Catherine says sharply. She scans his face. Is there some rift, some froideur?
They say Henry pursues other women.
Catherine's finger strokes the fur, absently, round and round, rubbing at the pelt.
It is so soon. They have only been married such a little space. I suppose she looks at the women about her and says to herself, always questioning, is it you, madam? Or you? It has always surprised me that those who are untrustworthy themselves are blind when placing their own trust. La Anna thinks she has friends. But if she does not give the king a son soon, they will turn on her.
He nods. You may be right. Who will turn first?
Why should I alert her? Catherine asks dryly. They say that when she is crossed, she carps like a common scold. I am not surprised. A queen, and she calls herself a queen, must live and suffer under the world's eye. No woman is above her but the Queen of Heaven, so she can look for no companionship in her troubles. If she suffers alone, and she needs a special grace to bear it. It appears Boleyn's daughter has not received this grace. I ask myself why that could be.
She breaks off. Her lips open and her flesh draws itself together, as if squirming away from her clothes. You are in pain, he starts to say, but she waves him to silence. It's nothing, nothing.
Gentlemen about the king who swear now they will lay down their lives for her smile will soon offer their devotion to another. They used to offer that same devotion to me. It was because I was the king's wife. It was nothing to do with my person. But La Anna takes it as a tribute to her charms. And besides, it is not just the men she should fear. Her sister-in-law, Jane Rochford, now there is a vigilant young woman. When she served me, she often brought secrets to me, love secrets. Secrets I would perhaps rather not know, and I doubt her ears and eyes are less sharp nowadays.
Still her fingers work away, now massaging a spot near her breastbone.
You wonder, how can Catherine, who is banished, know the workings of the court? That is for you to ponder.
I don't have to ponder long, he thinks. It is Nicholas Carew's wife, a particular friend of yours. And it is Gertrude Courtney, the Marquis of Exeter's wife. I caught her out in plotting last year. I should have locked her up. Perhaps even little Jane Seymour, though Jane has her own career to serve since Wolf Hall. I know you have your sources, he says. But should you trust them? They act in your name, but not in your best interests, or those of your daughter.
Will you let the princess visit me? If you think she needs counsel to steady her, who better than I?
If it stood to me, madam.
What harm can it do the king?
Put yourself in his place. I believe your ambassador Chapuis has written to Lady Mary saying he can get her out of the country.
Never. Chapuis can have no such thought. I guarantee it in my own person.
The king thinks that perhaps Mary might corrupt her guards, and if permitted to make a journey to see you, she might spur away and take ship for the territories of her cousin the emperor. It almost brings a smile to his lips to think of the skinny, scared little princess embarking on such a desperate and criminal course of action. Catherine smiles too, a twisted, malicious smile.
"And then what? Does Henry fear my daughter will come riding back with a foreign husband by her side and turn him out of his kingdom? You can assure him she has no such intention. I will answer for her again with my own person."
"Your own person must do a good deal, madam. Guarantee this, answer for that. You have only one death to suffer."
"I wish it might do Henry good. When my death arrives, in whatever manner, I hope to meet it in such a way as to set him an example when the time comes for his own."
"I see. Do you think a lot about the king's death?"
"I think about his afterlife."
"If you want to do his soul good, why do you continually obstruct him? It hardly makes him a better man. Do you never think that if you had bowed to the king's wishes years ago, if you had entered a convent and allowed him to remarry, he would never have broken with Rome? There would have been no need. Sufficient doubt was cast upon your marriage for you to retire with a good grace. You would have been honored by all, but now the titles you cling to are empty. Henry was a good son of Rome. You drove him to this extremity. You, not he, split Christendom. And I expect that you know that, and that you think about it in the silence of the night." There is a pause while she turns the great pages of her volume of rage and puts her finger on just the right word.
"What you say, Cromwell, is contemptible."
"She's probably right," he thinks. "But I will keep tormenting her, revealing her to herself, stripping her of any illusions, and I will do it for her daughter's sake. Mary is the future, the only grown child the king has, England's only prospect if God calls away Henry and the throne is suddenly empty." "So you won't be giving me one of those silk roses," he says. "I thought you might." A long look.
"At least, as an enemy, you stand in plain sight. I wish my friends could bear to be as conspicuous. The English are a nation of hypocrites."
"Ingrates," he agrees. "Natural liars. I found it myself. I would rather the Italians. The Florentines, so modest. The Venetians, transparent in all their dealing. And your own race, the Spaniards, such an honest people. They used to say of your royal father, Ferdinand, that his open heart would undo him."
"You are amusing yourself," she says, "at the expense of a dying woman."
"You want a great deal of credit for dying. You offer guarantees on the one hand, you want privileges on the other."
"A state such as mine, it usually buys kindness."
"I am trying to be kind, but you do not see it. At the last, madam, can you not put your own will aside and for the sake of your daughter reconcile with the king? If you leave this world at odds with him, blame will be visited on her, and she is young and has her life to live."
"He will not blame Mary. I know the king. He is not so mean a man."
He is silent. She still loves her husband, he thinks. In some kink or crevice of her old leathern heart, she is still hoping for his footstep, his voice. And with his gift to her hand, how can she forget that he once loved her? After all, there must have been weeks of work in the silk roses. He must have ordered them long before he knew the child was a boy.
"We called him the New Year's Prince," Wolsey had said. "He lived 52 days, and I counted every one."
England in winter, the pall of sliding snow blanketing the fields and palace roofs, smothering tile and gable, slipping silent over window glass, feathering the rutted tracks, weighting the boughs of oak and yew, sealing the fishes under ice and freezing the bird to the branch. He imagines the cradle, curtained in crimson, gilded with the arms of England, the rockers huddled into their clothes, a brazier burning, and the air fresh with the New Year scents of cinnamon and juniper, the roses brought to her triumphant bedside. How? In a gilded basket? In a long box like a coffin, a casket inlaid with polished shells? Or tumbled to her coverlet from a silk sheath embroidered with pomegranates? 2 happy months pass. The child thrives. It is understood through the world that the Tudors have an heir. And then on the 52nd day, a silence behind a curtain. A breath, not a breath. The women of the chamber snatch up the prince, crying in shock and fear. Hopelessly crossing themselves, they cower by the cradle to pray. "I will see what can be done," he says, "about your daughter, about a visit." How perilous can it be to bring one little girl across country? "I do think the king would permit it if he would advise Lady Mary to be in all respect conformable to his will, and recognize him, as now she does not, as head of the church."
"In that matter the Princess Mary must consult her own conscience."
She holds up a hand, palm towards him.
"I see you pity me, Cromwell. You should not. I have been prepared for death a long time. I believe that Almighty God will reward my efforts to serve him, and I shall see my little children again who have gone before me."
Your heart could break for her, he thinks, if it were not proof against breaking. She wants a martyr's death on the scaffold. Instead, she will die in the fens alone, choke on her own vomit, like as not. He says, "What about Lady Mary? Is she also ready to die?"
"The Princess Mary has meditated on Christ's passion since she was an infant in the nursery. She will be ready when he calls."
"You are an unnatural parent," he says. "What parent would risk a child's death?" But he remembers Walter Cromwell. Walter used to jump on me with his big boots. On me, his only son. He gathers himself for one last effort. "I have instanced to you, madam, a case where your stubbornness in setting yourself against the king and his council served only to bring about a result you most abhor. So you can be wrong, do you see? I ask you to consider that you may be wrong more than once. For the love of God, advise Mary to obey the king."
"The Princess Mary," she says dully.
She does not seem to have the breath for any further protest. He watches her for a moment and prepares to withdraw, but then she looks up.
"I have wondered, master, in what language do you confess? Or do you not confess?"
"God knows our hearts, madam. There is no need for an idle formula or for an intermediary. No need for language either," he thinks. "God is beyond translation." He falls out of the door and almost into the arms of Catherine's keeper. "Is my chamber ready?"
"But your supper?"
"Send me up a bowl of broth. I'm talked out. All I want is my bed."
"Anything in it?"
Beddingfield looks roguish. So his escort has informed on him.
"Just a pillow, Edmund."
Grace Beddingfield is disappointed he has retired so early. She thought she would get all the court news. She resents being stuck out here with the silent Spaniards, a long winter ahead. He must repeat the king's instructions. Utmost vigilance against the outside world. "I don't mind if Chapuis's letters get through, it will keep her occupied working the cipher. She isn't important to the Emperor, no, it's Mary he cares about. But no visitors, except under the king's seal or mine." Although, he breaks off. He can see the day next spring, and if Catherine is still alive, when the Emperor's army is riding up country, and it is necessary to snatch her out of their path and hold her hostage. It would be a poor show if Edmund refused to yield her. "Look," he shows his turquoise ring. "You see this? The late Cardinal gave it me, and I am known to wear it."
"Is that it? The magic one?"
Grace Beddingfield takes his hand.
"Melts stone walls, makes princesses fall in love with you?"
"This is the one. If any messenger brings you this, let him in." When he closes his eyes that night, a vault rises above him, the carved roof of Kimbolton's church. A man ringing handbells. A swan, a lamb, a cripple with a stick, two lovers' hearts entwined, and a pomegranate tree. Catherine's emblem. That might have to go. He yawns. Chisel them into apples, that'll fix it. I'm too tired for unnecessary effort. He remembers the woman at the inn and feels guilty. He pulls a pillow towards him. Just a pillow, Edmund. When the innkeeper's wife spoke to him as they were mounting their horses, she had said,
"Send me a present. Send me a present from London, something you can't get here."
It will have to be something she can wear on her back. Otherwise it will be vanished away by some light-fingered traveller. He will remember his obligation, but very likely by the time he returns to London he will have forgotten what she looked like. He had seen her by candlelight, and then the candle was out. When he saw her by daylight, she could have been a different woman. Perhaps she was. When he sleeps, he dreams of the fruit of the Garden of Eden, outstretched in Eve's plump hand. He wakes momentarily. If the fruit is ripe, when did those boughs blossom? In what possible month? In what possible spring? Schoolmen will have addressed the question. A dozen furrowed generations, tonsured heads bent, chilblained fingers fumbling scrolls. It's the sort of silly question monks are made for. I'll ask Cranmer, he thinks, my archbishop. Why doesn't Henry ask Cranmer's advice if he wants to be rid of Anne? It was Cranmer who divorced him from Catherine. He would never tell him he must go back to her stale bed. But no, Henry cannot speak of his doubts in that quarter. Cranmer loves Anne. He thinks her the pattern of a Christian woman, the hope of good Bible readers all over Europe. He sleeps again, and dreams of the flowers made before the dawn of the world. They are made of white silk. There is no bush or stem to pluck them from. They lie on the bare, uncreated ground. He looks closely at Anne the Queen the day he brings back his report. She looks sleek, contented, and the benign domestic hum of their voices as he approaches tell him that she and Henry are in harmony. They are busy, their heads together. The king has his drawing instruments to hand, his compasses and pencils, his rules, inks and penknives. The table is covered in unscrolling plans and in artificers' moulds and batons. He makes them his reverence and comes to the point. She is not well, and I believe it would be a kindness to let her have a visit from Ambassador Chapuis. Anne shoots out of her chair.
What, so he can intrigue with her more conveniently?
Her doctors suggest, madam, that she will soon be in her grave, and not able to work you any displeasure.
She would come out of it, flapping in her shroud if she saw the chance to thwart me.
Henry stretches out a hand.
Sweetheart, Chapuis has never acknowledged you, but when Catherine is gone and can no longer make trouble for us, I will make sure he bends his knee.
Nevertheless, I do not think he should go out of London. He encourages Catherine in her perversity, and she encourages her daughter.
She darts a glance at him.
Cromwell, you agree, do you not? Mary should be brought to court and made to kneel before her father and swear the oath, and there on her knees she should beg pardon for her treasonous obstinacy and acknowledge that my daughter, and not she, is heir to England.
He indicates the plans.
Not building, sir.
Henry looks like a child caught with his fingers in the sugar box. He pushes one of the batons towards him. The designs, still novel to the English eye, are those he grew accustomed to in Italy. Fluted urns and vases, mantled and winged, and the sightless heads of emperors and gods. These days the native flowers and trees, the winding stems and blossoms are disdained for wreathed arms, for the laurels of victory, the shaft of the lictor's axe, the shaft of the spear. He sees that Anne's status is not served by simplicity. For more than 7 years now, Henry has been adapting his taste to hers. Henry used to enjoy hedge wines, the fruits of the English summer, but now the wines he favours are heavy, perfumed, drowsy. His body is heavy, so sometimes he seems to block out the light.
"Are we building from the foundations?" he inquires. "Or just a layer of ornamentation. Both cost money.
"How ungracious you are," Anne says. "The king is sending you some oak for your own building at Hackney, and some for Master Sadler for his new house."
With a dip of his head, he signals his thanks. But the king's mind is up country, with the woman who still claims to be his wife.
"What use is Catherine's life to her now?" Henry asks. "I am sure she is tired of contention." "God knows I am tired of it. She were better to join the saints and holy martyrs."
"They have waited for her long enough,"
Anne laughs, too loudly.
"I picture the lady dying," the king says. "She will be making speeches and forgiving me. She is always forgiving me. It is she who needs forgiveness. For her blighted womb, for poisoning my children before they were born."
He, Cromwell, flits his eyes to Anne. Surely now, if she has anything to tell, is the moment. But she turns away, leans down and scoops her spaniel Purkoi into her lap. She buries her face in his fur, and the little dog, startled from his sleep, whimpers and twists in her hands, and watches Master Secretary bow himself out. Outside, waiting for him, George Boleyn's wife, her confiding hand drawing him aside, her whisper. If someone said to Lady Rochford, "It's raining," she would turn it into a conspiracy. As she passed the news on, she would make it sound somehow indecent, unlikely, but sadly true. "Well," he says, "is she?"
"Ah, has she said nothing still? Of course the wise woman says nothing till she feels it quickening."
He regards her, stony-eyed.
"Yes,"
she says at last, casting a nervous glance over her shoulder.
"She has been wrong before, but yes."
"Does the king know?"
"You should tell him, Cromwell. Be the man with good news. Who knows, he might knight you on the spot."
He is thinking, "Fetch me Ralph Sadler. Fetch me Thomas Risley. Send a letter to Edward Seymour. Whistle up my nephew Richard. Cancel supper with Chapuis. But don't let our dishes go to waste. Let's invite Sir Thomas Boleyn."
"I suppose it is to be expected," Jane Rochford says. "She was with the king for much of the summer, was she not? A week here, a week there. And when he was not with her, he would write her love letters and send them by the hand of Harry Norris."
"My lady, I must leave you. I have business."
"I'm sure you have. Ah, well. And you are usually such a good listener. You always attend to what I say. And I say that this summer he wrote her love letters and sent them by the hand of Harry Norris."
He is moving too fast to make much of her last sentence, though, as he will admit later, the detail will affix itself and adhere to certain sentences of his own not yet formed. Phrases only. Elliptic. Conditional. As everything is conditional now. Anne blossoming as Catherine fails. He pictures them, their faces intent and skirts bunched, two little girls in a muddy track, playing teeter-totter with a plank balanced on a stone. Thomas Seymour says at once,
"This is Jane's chance now. He will hesitate no more. He will want a new bedfellow. He will not touch the queen till she gives birth. He cannot. There is too much to lose."
He thinks, already perhaps the secret King of England has fingers, has a face. "But I thought that before," he reminds himself, "at her coronation, when Anne carried her belly so proudly, and, after all, it was only a girl."
"I still don't see it," says old Sir John, the adulterer. "I don't see how he'd want Jane. Now, if it were my daughter Bess, the king has danced with her. He liked her very well."
"Bess is married," Edward says. Tom Seymour laughs. "The more fit for his purpose." Edward is irate. "Don't talk of Bess. Bess would not have him. Bess is not in question."
"It could turn to good,"
Sir John says, tentative.
"For until now, Jane's never been any use to us."
"True," Edward says. "Jane is as much use as a blancmange. I'll let her earn her keep. The king will need a companion. But we do not push her in his way. Let it be as Cromwell here has advised. Henry has seen her. He has formed his intent. Now she must avoid him. No, she must repel him."
"Oh, hoity-toity,"
old Seymour says.
if you can afford it.
Afford what's chaste, what's seemly? Edward snaps. You never could. Be quiet, you old lecher. The king pretends to forget your crimes, but no one really forgets. You are pointed at. The old goat who stole his son's bride.
Yes, hold your peace, father, Tom says. We're talking to Cromwell.
One thing I am afraid of, he says. Your sister loves her old mistress, Catherine. This is well known to the present queen, who spares no opportunity for harshness. If she sees that the king is looking at Jane, I'm afraid she will be further persecuted. Anne is not one to sit by while her husband makes a companion of another woman, even if she thought it a temporary arrangement.
Jane will pay no heed, Edward says. What though she gets a pinch or a slap? She will know how to bear herself patiently.
She will play him for some great reward, says old Seymour.
Tom Seymour says, he made Anne a marquise before he had her.
Edward's face is as grim as if he is ordering up an execution. You know what he made her. Marquise first, queen thereafter. Parliament is prorogued, but London lawyers, flapping their black gowns like crows, settle to their winter term. The happy news seeps and leaks through the court. Anne lets out her bodices. Bets are laid. Pens scribble. Letters are folded. Seals pressed to wax. Horses are mounted. Ships set sail. The old families of England kneel and ask God why he favours the Tudors. King Francis frowns. Emperor Charles sucks his lip. King Henry dances. The conversation at Elvetham, that early hour's confabulation, it is as if it had never been. The king's doubts about his marriage, it seems, have vanished. Though in the desolate winter gardens, he has been seen walking with Jane. Her family surround her. They call him in.
What did he say, sister? Edward Seymour demands. Tell me everything. Everything he said.
Jane says, he asked me if I would be his good mistress. They exchange glances. There is a difference between a mistress and a good mistress. Does Jane know that? The first implies concubinage. The second, something less immediate. An exchange of tokens, a chaste and languorous admiration, a prolonged courtship. Though it can't be very prolonged, of course, or Anne will have given birth and Jane will have missed her chance. The women cannot predict when the heir will see the light, and he can get no further with Anne's doctors.
Look, Jane, Edward tells her, this is no time to be shy. You must give us particulars.
He asked me if I would look kindly on him.
Kindly on him when?
For instance, if he wrote me a poem, praising my beauty. So I said I would. I would thank him for it. I wouldn't laugh, even behind my hand. And I wouldn't raise any objection to any statements he might make in verse, even if they were exaggerated, because in poems it is usual to exaggerate.
He, Cromwell, congratulates her. You have it covered from every angle, Mistress Seymour. You would have made a sharp lawyer.
You mean, if I had been born a man?
She frowns.
But still, it is not likely, Master Secretary. The Seymours are not tradesmen.
Edward Seymour says, good mistress, write you verse.
Very well.
Good so far. But if he attempts anything on your person, you must scream.
Jane says, what if nobody came?
He puts his hand on Edward's arm. He wants to stop this scene developing any further. Listen, Jane, don't scream. Pray. Pray aloud, I mean. Mental prayer will not do it. Say a prayer with the Holy Virgin in it, something that will appeal to His Majesty's piety and sense of honour.
I understand, Jane says. Do you have a prayer book on your person, Master Secretary? Brothers? No matter. I will go and look for mine. I am sure I can find something that will fit the bill.
In early December, he receives word from Catherine's doctors that she is eating better, though praying no less. Death has moved, perhaps, from the head of the bed to its foot. Her recent pains have eased and she is lucid. She uses the time to make her bequests. She leaves her daughter Mary a gold collar she brought from Spain and her furs.
She asks for 500 masses to be said for her soul and for a pilgrimage to be made to Walsingham. Details of the dispositions make their way back to Whitehall.
"These furs," Henry says. "Have you seen them, Cromwell? Are they any good? If they are, I want them sent down to me."
Teeter-totter. The women around Anne say you would not think she was enceinte. In October she looked well enough, but now she seems to be losing flesh rather than gaining. Jane Rochford tells him, "You would almost think she is ashamed of her condition. And His Majesty is not attentive to her, as formerly he was attentive when her belly was big. Then he could not do enough for her. He would cater to her whims and wait on her like a maid. I once came in to find her feet in his lap, and he rubbing them like an ostler nursing some splay-hooved mare."
"Rubbing doesn't help a splayed hoof," he says, earnest. "You have to trim it and fit a special shoe."
Rochford stares at him.
"Have you been talking to Jane Seymour?"
"Why?"
"Never mind," she says.
He has seen Anne's face as she watches the king, as she watches the king watching Jane. You expect black anger and the enactment of it, scissored up sewing, broken glass. Instead, her face is narrow. She holds her jeweled sleeve across her body where the child is growing.
"I must not disturb myself," she says. "It could injure the prince."
She pulls her skirts aside when Jane passes. She huddles into herself, narrow shoulders shrinking. She looks cold as a doorstep orphan. Teeter-totter. The rumour in the country is that Master Secretary has brought a woman back from his recent trip to Hertfordshire, or Bedfordshire, and set her up in his house at Stepney, or at Austin Friars, or at King's Place in Hackney, which he is rebuilding for her in lavish style. She is the keeper of an inn, and her husband has been seized and locked up for a new crime invented by Thomas Cromwell. The poor cuckold is to be charged and hanged at the next assize, though by some reports he has already been found dead in his prison, bludgeoned, poisoned, and with his throat cut. Chapter 3. Angels. Stepney and Greenwich. Christmas 1535 to New Year 1536. Christmas morning. He comes hurtling out in pursuit of whatever trouble is next. A huge toad blocks his path.
"Is that Matthew?"
From the amphibian mouth, a juvenile chortle.
"Simon! Merry Christmas, sir! How do you?"
He sighs. "Overworked. Did you send your duties to your mother and father?" The singing children go home in the summer. At Christmas they are busy singing.
"Will you be going to see the king, sir?"
Simon croaks.
"I bet their plays at court are not so good as ours. We are playing Robin Hood, and King Arthur is in it. I play Merlin's toad. Master Richard Cromwell plays the Pope and has a begging bowl. He cries, 'Mumpsimus, Sumpsimus, Hocus Pocus.' We give him stones for alms. He threatens us with hell."
He pats Simon's warty skin. The toad clears his path with a ponderous hop. Since his return from Kimbolton, London has closed around him. Late autumn, her fading and melancholy evenings, her early dark. The sedate and ponderous arrangements of the court have enfolded him, entrapped him into desk-bound days prolonged by candlelight into desk-bound nights. Sometimes he would give a king's ransom to see the sun. He is buying land in the lusher parts of England, but he has no leisure to visit it. So these farms, these ancient manors in their walled gardens, these watercourses with their little quays, these ponds with their gilded fish rising to the hook, these vineyards, flower gardens, arbours and walks remain to him flat, each one a paper construct, a set of figures on a page of accounts, not sheep-nibbled margins nor meadows where kine stand knee-deep in grass, not coppices nor groves where a white doe shivers, a hoof poised, but parchment domains, leases and freeholds delimited by inky clauses, not by ancient hedges or boundary stones. His acres are notional acres, sources of income, sources of dissatisfaction in the small hours when he wakes up and his mind explores their geography. In these waking nights before sullen or frozen dawns, he thinks not of the freedom his holdings allow, but of the trampling intrusion of others, their easements and rights of way, their fences and vantage points that allow them to impinge on his boundaries and interfere with his quiet possession of his future. Christ knows he is no country boy, though where he grew up, in the streets near the quays, Putney Heath was at his back, a place to go missing. He spent long days there, running with his brethren, boys as rough as himself, all of them in flight from their fathers, from their belts and fists, and from the education they were threatened with if they ever stood still. But London pulled him to her urban gut. Long before he sailed the Thames in Master Secretary's barge, he knew the currents and the tide, and he knew how much could be picked up casually at watermen's trades by unloading boats and running crates in barrows uphill to the fine houses that lined the Strand, the houses of lords and bishops, the houses of men with whom daily he now sits down at the council board. The winter court perambulates, its accustomed circuit. Greenwich and Eltham, the houses of Henry's childhood, Whitehall and Hampton Court, once the cardinal's houses. It is usual these days for the king, wherever the court resides, to dine alone in his private rooms. Outside the royal apartments, in the outer watching chamber, or the guard chamber, in whatever that outer hall is named, in the palaces in which we find ourselves, there is a top table, where the Lord Chamberlain, head of the king's private household, holds court for the nobility. Uncle Norfolk sits at this table, when he is with us at court. So does Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk, and the Queen's father, the Earl of Wiltshire. And there is a table, somewhat lower in status, but served with due honour, for functionaries like himself, and for the old friends of the king who happen not to be peers. Nicholas Carew sits there, Master of the Horse, and William Fitzwilliam, Master Treasurer, who of course has known Henry since he was a boy. William Paulet, Master Comptroller, presides at the head of this board, and he wonders, until it is explained to him, at their habit of lifting their goblets and their eyebrows in a toast to someone not there. Till Paulet explains, half embarrassed, "We toast the man who sat here before me, Master Comptroller who was, Sir Henry Guildford, his blessed memory. You knew him, Cromwell, of course." Indeed, who did not know Guildford, that practiced diplomat, that most studied of courtiers? A man of the king's own age, he had been Henry's right arm since he came to the throne, he an unpracticed, well-meaning, optimistic prince of 19. Two glowing spirits, earnest in pursuit of glory and a good time, the master and servant had aged together. He would have backed Guildford to survive an earthquake, but he did not survive Anne Boleyn. His partisanship was clear. He loved Queen Catherine, and said so. "And if I did not love her," he said, "then propriety alone and my Christian conscience would compel me to back her case." The king had excused him out of long friendship. "Only let us," he had pleaded, "leave the matter unmentioned, the disagreement unstated. Do not mention Anne Boleyn. Make it possible for us to stay friends." But silence had not been enough for Anne. "The day I am queen," she had told Guildford, "is the day you lose your job." "Madam," said Sir Henry Guildford, "the day you become queen is the day I resign." And so he did. Henry said, "Come on, man, don't let a woman nag you out of your post. It's just women's jealousy and spite. Ignore it." "But I fear for myself," Guildford said, "for my family and my name." "Do not abandon me," said the king. "Blame your new wife," Henry Guildford said. And so he quit the court and went home to the country. "And died," says William Fitzwilliam, "within a few short months, they say, of a broken heart." A sigh runs around the table. That's the way it takes, men. Life's work over, rural ennui stretching ahead, a procession of days, Sunday to Sunday, all without shape. What is there without Henry, without the radiance of his smile? It's like perpetual November, a life in the dark.
"Wherefore we remember him," Sir Nicholas Carew says, "our old friend. And we drink a toast," Paulet here does not mind, "to the man who would still be Master Comptroller if the times were not out of joint."
He has a gloomy way of making a toast, Sir Nicholas Carew. Levity is unknown to one so dignified. He, Cromwell, had been sitting at table for a week before Sir Nicholas deigned to turn a cold eye upon him and nudge the mutton his way. But their relations have eased since then. After all, he, Cromwell, is an easy man to get along with. He sees that there is a camaraderie among men such as these, men who have lost out to the Boleyns, a defiant camaraderie, such as exists among those sectaries in Europe who are always expecting the end of the world, but who hope that after the earth has been consumed by fire, they will be seated in glory. Grilled a little, crisp at the edges and blackened in parts, but still, thanks be to God, alive for eternity and seated at his right hand. He knew Henry Guildford himself, as Paulet reminds him. It must be 5 years ago now that he had been entertained by him handsomely at Leeds Castle down in Kent. It was only because Guildford wanted something, of course, a favour from my Lord Cardinal. But still, he had learned from Guildford's table talk, from the way he ordered his household, from his prudence and discreet wit. More lately, he had learned from Guildford's example how Anne Boleyn could break a career, and how far they were from forgiving her, his companions at table. Men like Carew, he knows, tend to blame him, Cromwell, for Anne's rise in the world. He facilitated it. He broke the old marriage and let in the new. He does not expect them to soften to him, to include him in their companionship. He only wants them not to spit in his dinner. But Carew's stiffness bends a little as he joins them in talk. Sometimes the master of the horse swivels towards him his long, indeed somewhat equine head. Sometimes he gives him a slow courser's blink and says, "Well, Master Secretary, and how are you today?" And as he searches for a reply that Nicholas will understand, William Fitzwilliam will catch his eye and grin. During December, a landslide, an avalanche of papers has crossed his desk. Often he ends the day smarting and thwarted, because he had sent Henry vital and urgent messages, and the gentlemen of the Privy Chamber have decided it's easier for them if they keep the business back till Henry's in the mood. Despite the good news he has had from the Queen, Henry is testy, capricious. At any moment he may demand the oddest item of information, or pose questions with no answer. What's the market price of Berkshire wool? Do you speak Turkish? Why not? Who does speak Turkish? Who was the founder of the monastery at Hexham? 7 shilling the sack and rising, Majesty. No, because I was never in those parts. I will find a man if one can be got. St. Wilfrid, sir. He closes his eyes. I believe the Scots raised it and it was built up again in the time of the first Henry. Why does Luther think, the king demands, that I should come into conformity with his church? Should he not think of coming into conformity with me? About St. Lucy's Day, Anne calls him in, taking him from the affairs of Cambridge University. But Lady Rochford is there to check him before he reaches her, put a hand on his arm. She is a sorry sight. She cannot stop blubbing. Have you not heard? Her little dog is dead. We could not face telling her. We had to ask the king himself to do it. Purkoy, her favourite. Jane Rochford conducts him in, glances at Anne. Poor lady. Her eyes are cried to slits. Do you know, Lady Rochford murmurs, when she miscarried her last child, she did not shed a tear. The women skirt around Anne, keeping their distance as if she were barbed. He remembers what Gregory said. Anne is all elbows and points. You could not comfort her. Even a hand extended, she would regard as a presumption or a threat. Catherine is right. A queen is alone, whether in the loss of her husband, her spaniel, or her child. She turns her head. Cromwell, she orders her women out, a vehement gesture, a child scaring crows. Unhurried, like bold corvines of some new and silky kind, the ladies gather their trains, flap languidly away, their voices, like voices from the air, trail behind them, their gossip broken off, their knowing cackles of laughter. Lady Rochford is the last to take wing, trailing her feathers, reluctant to yield the ground. Now there is no one in the room but himself and Anne and her dwarf humming in the corner, waggling her fingers before her face. I am so sorry, he says, his eyes down. He knows better than to say, you can get another dog.
They found him,
Anne throws out a hand,
out there, down in the courtyard. The window was open above. His neck was broken.
She does not say he must have fallen, because clearly this is not what she thinks.
Do you remember you were here that day my cousin Francis Bryan brought him from Calais? Francis walked in, and I had Burkoy off his arm before you could blink. He was a creature who did no harm. What monster would find it in their heart to pick him up and kill him?
He wants to soothe her. She seems as torn, as injured, as if the attack had been on her person. Probably he crept out on the sill, and then his paws slipped. Those little dogs, you expect them to fall on their feet like a cat, but they don't. I had a spaniel jumped out of my son's arms because she saw a mouse, and she snapped her leg. It's easily done.
What happened to her?
He says gently, we could not mend her. He glances up at the fool. She is grinning in her corner and jerking her fists apart in a snapping motion. Why does Anne keep the thing? She should be sent to a hospital. Anne scrubs at her cheeks, all her fine French manners fallen away. She uses her knuckles like a little girl.
What is the news from Kim Bolton?
She finds a handkerchief and blows her nose.
They say Catherine could live 6 months.
He does not know what to say. Perhaps she wants him to send a man to Kim Bolton to drop Catherine from a height.
The French ambassador complains he came twice to your house, and you would not see him.
I was busy, he shrugs.
With?
I was playing bowls in the garden. Yes, twice. I practice constantly, because if I lose a game, I am in a rage all day, and I go looking for papists to kick. Once, Anne would have laughed. Not now.
I myself do not care for this ambassador. He does not give me his respect, as the envoy before did. Nonetheless, you must be careful of him. You must do him all honour, because it is only King Francis who is keeping the Pope from our throats.
Farnese as wolf, snarling and dripping bloody drool. He is not sure she is in a mood to be talked to, but he will try. It is not for love of us that Francis helps us.
I know it is not for love,
she teases out her wet handkerchief, looking for a dry bit.
Not for love of me, anyway. I am not such a fool.
It is only that he does not want the Emperor Charles to overrun us and make himself master of the world. And he does not like the bull of excommunication. He does not think it right that the Bishop of Rome or any priest should set himself up to deprive a king of his own country. But I wish France would see his own interest. It is a pity that there is not a skilled man to open to him the advantages of doing as our sovereign lord has done, and taking the headship of his own church.
But there are not 2 Cromwells,
she manages a sour smile. He waits. Does he know how the French now see her? They no longer believe she can influence Henry. They think she is a spent force. And though the whole of England has taken an oath to uphold her children, no one abroad believes that, if she fails to give Henry a son, the little Elizabeth can reign. As the French ambassador said to him, the last time he let him in, if the choice is between 2 females, why not prefer the elder? If Mary's blood is Spanish, at least it is royal, and at least she can walk straight and has control of her bowels. From her corner, the creature, the dwarf, comes shuffling towards Anne on her bottom. She pulls at her mistress's skirts.
Get away, Mary,
Anne says. She laughs at his expression.
Did you not know I have rebaptized my fool? The king's daughter is almost a dwarf, is she not? Even more squat than her mother. The French would be shocked if they saw her. I think a glimpse of her would scuttle their intentions. Oh, I know Cromwell. I know what they are trying to do behind my back. They had my brother to and fro for talks, but they never meant to make a marriage with Elizabeth.
Ah, he thinks. She grasps it at last.
This ends Disc 3.